We're going to go straight to Q&A with you. Why? You mentioned you thought that only 40% of the cases in general are asymptomatic. Why do you think it's that number? I had heard that it was much more.
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I don't know if we know that exact proportion. However, the CDC on July 10th put out a statement that they think the rate of not having symptoms at all with this infection is 40%. And where did they get that particular statistic? Up till that point, till July 10th, there were many studies where you test a group of people. You have to mass test everyone because you don't know who has symptoms or not. So, for example, mass test a neighborhood, like in the Mission District in San Francisco, or mass test a nursing home, or mass test inpatients, or mass test a group of people. Follow them out for 2 weeks because you have to make sure they don't get symptoms, because then they become the word pre-symptomatic, not asymptomatic. And putting all this data together, and there was a Annals of Internal Medicine review on this, it looked like up to that point, the rate of asymptomatic infection was deemed at 40%. And that's the statistic that's quoted at this moment. You're absolutely right. That was July 10th. If we look now, could there be populations where that rate of asymptomatic infection is higher? It seems so. In fact, that's part of the evidence that we're wondering about with masking, is that in outbreaks in food processing plants, for example, where everyone's masking, 500 people got infected in an outbreak in a Tyson chicken plant and also an Oregon seafood processing plant. They were all masking, and the rate of asymptomatic infection was 95%. We have a paper under review where these three companies, everyone was masking, there was testing done, and people had the infection, but the rate of asymptomatic infection was 99%. So you are right that this number is all over the place. And what is one of those factors that could be driving up the rate of asymptomatic infection? Keeping away from each other, social distancing, and wearing a mask. And that could be reducing, even if you get infected, the amount of virus you get in, and driving up that rate of asymptomatic infection. So
I think that is actually, when I read your paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, I took that as your key point. And let me articulate what I learned. And it's that that masks may not be very good at preventing exposure. What masks may be good at is minimizing the viral load. And it may be the viral load which creates the asymptomatic or the severity of the disease. Is that fair?
Yes. So I think if we think about masks, there are different types of masks. So an N95 mask, that really strong, tightly fitting mask with lots of layer, sort of barriers to getting in virus, probably blocks out virus the most. And that's used in hospitals. We've sort of restricted that to healthcare workers, and it's also super uncomfortable. So cloth face mask coverings, which have been recommended by the WHO and the CDC, they don't block out all viral particles. And I would say there's some very important physical scientists who are estimating 75%, 85% that they block out, and some of this data will be coming. And if you block out the majority of virus but not all, getting a little bit of virus in, if you get infected and you're not likely to get sick, then that's driving up the rate of asymptomatic infection. And it's a hypothesis, but we've been seeing it in what is called observational studies. Can you prove it? Well, you can't give people a little bit of virus, a lot of virus. You can't do that experiment. That is unethical in human experimentation. But with other viruses, they've done that, less deadly viruses. They've given people a little bit of influenza, a lot of influenza, and they get less sick with a little bit and more sick with a lot. So
would you describe that as like a live vaccine? A live virus vaccine is what we're really doing? Is it really like that old classic study back in the cowpox? You know, when they rub that, or maybe it was even alive, a little bit of smallpox. I don't even know how it really worked.
It was both, actually, that the way to vaccinate people against smallpox with this deadly virus before we had vaccines was giving someone a little bit of a related virus, or even the actual virus, like a scab from someone who had smallpox, and then you get a mild illness, and then you get immunity. Now, that process called variolation is not ethical now. Like, we would never, ever propound that people get deliberately sick. However, people are out. People are working. Essential workers are working. Hospital care workers are working. People in grocery stores are working. People are out. They have to be out. There is not everyone is privileged enough to be able to stay home. And because of that, the question is, as people are out and doing their functions, are they being exposed to a little bit of virus and getting the infection, but they don't even know it? And that's the question. We have a lot more to work on, but that is exactly the hypothesis that you just said.
Rick, did you want to ask a question?
Monica, this is very limited. Let me say the one thing that troubles me a little is you mentioned N95 as being very uncomfortable, which has not been my experience in wearing the N95. But let me put that aside and say, Monica, how do we get the message across, though, to people that mask wearing is essential to fighting this virus? How is it that we get beyond the unevenness that we've had with mask wearing? Do you have any ideas about that?
Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, I think it is essential, and I'm really become convinced of that, especially when I look at the Asia countries. And what I mean is, you know, Thailand and Vietnam and South Korea and Hong Kong and Taiwan and Japan, where there hasn't been this aspect of uneven messaging, and their rates of severe illness have been so low, and they have been open. We don't recognize how much they are out doing their job functions. We don't tend to focus on those countries enough, but they have been open for months. So, I mean, definitely avoiding large crowds and still keeping with many precautions, but there's a lot more openness of that society than here. So my ideas for increasing mask wearing is number one, mask modeling by leaders. I think it makes a huge difference when a leader is modeling that they believe in this pillar of pandemic control by wearing that mask right before they can take it off as they're speaking if they're enough away from people. But that had not been done with President Trump and his administration. Second is mask provision. I think in essential healthcare worker settings, in essential grocery stores, for example, in meat processing plants, in places where people are closer and you're asking people to wear masks, providing them with masks. And what I mean by that is what you just said about the N95 mask is interesting. The other aspect of our uneven response here is we have like a bunch of masks, like people can grab this and put this over their face. And, you know, there's been standardization of the type of mask that people wear in many Asian countries. Taiwan is a great example. Surgical masks, which are quite tightly bound, they have multiple layers, and they have electrostatic charges that block virus. These were mass-produced in Taiwan on March 6th. Taiwan, on March 6th, mass-produced masks, gave them out to their public, and they've had fewer than a dozen deaths from coronavirus, 23 million people country. So it is important to say that there are responses where you mass produced a standard product and you provide them to the public. And that has also not been part of our response. We are all over the place with the type of mask. So I'm also in favor of standardization.
I also, when you look at people who are wearing masks, it seems to me that you see people who take it, I'll call it seriously, and people who don't. You know, when you see people with their mask kind of below their nose or even on their chin, where it's obviously doing little to no good. I think you need more than just wearing it. There's a proper way to wear it and an improper way to wear it. How do we kind of persuade them on that?
Well, so, I mean, it's really the big holes in the face or the two nostrils and the mouth. That's where you can get virus in, and that's where you put virus out. Anything else, skin and even eyes, very little, skin has no transmission, and eyes, it's quite difficult actually to get COVID through your eyes. So it really is your two nostrils and your mouth. So you've got to cover those two nostrils and mouth because you could be putting out virus even when you're well, and also cover them for your protection. And
just one more quick thing. When at the beginning of the crisis, yeah, we were told not to open up our Amazon packages, to leave them aside for 3 days. Was that just complete nonsense?
It wasn't nonsense. It was an understandable fear of what could be going on. This is spreading so fast. It's so different than SARS. Why its cousin in 2003? What's going on? And so there was, and also you could culture virus from surfaces, which is also very confusing. But by the way, you can do that with many, many viruses. And so it was an overabundance of caution to say, fomites and surfaces could cover this. Let's do this. At this point, this long into the pandemic, most experts are not concerned about surfaces spreading virus. And in fact, you can see that if that was truly a concern, we'd be recommending a different form of protection for our hands and, you know, gloves and things that we do in the hospital. None of this has been part of the pandemic response.
We were rubbing ourselves with alcohol. We were, you know, constantly when we entered a room, we were soaping ourselves down. We were very worried about touching the, you know, the button in the elevator. Are all those concerns now completely tertiary, and our complete focus should be on making sure that our masks are tightly fit?
Yes. So essentially, hand hygiene is absolutely part of the response, and hand hygiene is always a good thing to do. It's always been part of reducing spread of respiratory viruses. But right, like going to extreme lengths to disinfect the whole room, or sort of, you know, like letting people breathe in chemicals all the time from disinfectant. I mean, these we need to start thinking long term, and right, a lot of those concerns have gone away. And again, it's just because you can culture a virus from a surface does not mean that's how it spread. And I think we just have had a bunch of scientists getting into the mix, you know, understandably, but physical scientists and engineers, and there's just been a plethora of people. You can get things published quite quickly. Like it's kind of an amazing time where everyone's in the mix, but that can be really confusing, right, for the public. And so a respiratory virus is spread from what comes out of your nose and what you get into your nose and mouth, right? And so that is the main route of spread of this virus. You are correct.
You mentioned in the pregame that the knives are out between scientists right now, and that there's a lot of disagreement and a lot of emotion associated with what to recommend or what science we kept out of this, given we're at the early stages. Why do you think in the scientific community, you mentioned differences, I'll call it in the political community, but what's going on with it within the scientific community that the experts themselves have the knives out for each other?
You know, I have watched that with wonder, and I think it's a profoundly emotional time, and there's a lot of polemics. And polemics means that people, you know, science is not a fixed thing. It never has been. People were killed for, you know, saying the Earth was flat, or that the Earth, you know, is not the center of the universe. Science is never a fixed thing. As data evolves, things change. But right now, this is a brand new pandemic. Everyone has their personal biases. A personal bias of a medical doctor like myself is that the effects of the economy and job loss and all this painful breakdown and loneliness and social isolation, I treat people living with HIV, is profoundly difficult. And it makes my daily bias in my head think about how can I let people see each other but keep safe. Like, that's my bias as an MD. A PhD epidemiologist who doesn't have that experience maybe have sat in their house for a long time over the last 11 months. And that is profoundly influencing their bias about what they choose to believe about this virus, right? Like, it is amazing to me that every human being has bias. Every single person in this country has made a decision about what they think about this virus. And because the information is so new, you can go this way and you can go that way, and you're not thinking in a nuanced, holistic fashion, putting all the data together. We also have data coming from all sources, some of which is totally confusing and doesn't actually make sense, and coming from a bunch of scientific fields. So we haven't settled on this. And because of that, there's yelling. Yeah, there's yelling, there's anger, there's polemics, there's an amazing time where people are, you're either on this side or you're this side, you hate masks, you think masks are good. Like, it's none of that is actually, like, based on truth. Everyone is based on their personal emotion around this virus. I will tell you that this has happened many, many times, right? Like in the mid-1800s in Paris with the cholera pandemic, there was a bunch of scientists that said, this is fecal oral, which it is. It was spread through sewage and fecal oral. And the other ones were like, this is spread by people being around each other. Shut everything down. And there was different scientists on different sides, and they were screaming at each other, and no one was paying attention to the impact on the poor, which both sides were hurting, because shutting everything down wasn't good for the poor, and then also just saying that the dirty poor are the ones who are spreading cholera also wasn't good for the poor. So there was just polemics, and we will look back at this time in history and realize how much we screamed at each other.
Monica, thank you very much.